Well, welcome to the Adventist Forum this afternoon. Glad you're all here, and you're also welcome to join the rest of the crew on this side. Or maybe you're in the VIP seating over there. Yeah. Anyway, well, today's program is The Sacred Theater of Knowing, the Epistemologies of Hamlet on Film, and it's presented by Dr. Monique Pittman from the English Department, who is full professor of English and also director of the honors program here at Andrews. And then after the discussion, as usual, we'll have a question, answer, comment time, and Brian Strayer will have a mic to take around to amplify your questions and comments. As we begin, Bev Matiko is going to offer a word of prayer.
Holy God, we're thankful that we can meet together as friends and believers and inquirers. We ask you to be with us and bless our time together as we learn. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, you know, I always like to have a little quotation here to throw in this program. This time I actually took it from the website of our speaker. She has a little biography section, and she begins it with a quotation, which, as you might suspect, comes from a Shakespeare play. No surprise. Make the doors upon a woman's wit, and it will out at the casement. Shut that, and twill out at the keyhole. Stop that, twill fly up with the smoke out at the chimney. Now, interestingly, she didn't include the preceding lines, which have been paraphrased in the Cliff's Notes sort of thing, that if she weren't wise, she wouldn't be smart enough to behave badly. The wiser the woman, the wilder. So in any case, we're looking forward to some learning from the wit of a wise woman today. So our next forum presentation is on March 8. Ron Coffin and Tiago Baltazar from the School of Education we'll be discussing the role of doubt in religious identity development and psychological maturity. They've done some published research in that area. I think it should be a fascinating discussion. Then on April 12, Dr. Ben MacArthur, who's a historian at Southern Adventist University, will be speaking to us about A.G. Daniels, who you may remember was the longest-serving president of the General Conference. And I think he's currently working or just completed a biography on A.G. Daniels. There are, as usual, some sign-up sheets in the back. If some of you are not getting email notification and would like to, well, I put your name and email address down there and we'll add you to the list. And again, we thank Jim Harris for helping us with the technical stuff and Debbie and Terry for helping us with the publicity. Well, as mentioned, today's presentation is titled The Sacred Theater of Knowing, the Epistemologies of Hamlet on Film. Dr. Pittman completed her BA in English here at Andrews with a minor in music. She went on to earn an MA from the College of William and Mary in Virginia and a PhD in Renaissance Literature at Purdue University. She's been teaching here at Andrews since 1999. Currently, she's professor of English and director of the Honors Program. She's been fascinated by the literature of the Renaissance. She says since childhood, says she even had a picture of Queen Elizabeth I in her high school locker. And is fascinated by the nuanced and complex treatment of the human condition in the literature of the time. Her husband, Paul, also is analytical, but not analyzing literature, but analyzing numbers, is a CPA, and he's good support for her and here with her today. They enjoy cooking, baking, kitchen gardening, working home improvement magic, and whatever else that didn't make it to the list. So welcome to the Adventist Forum. We look forward to your presentation.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much. So The Sacred Theater of Knowing, the Epistemologies of Hamlet on Film. Adventist Forum has long endeavored to bring to bear on our shared community of faith the insight of scholarly discovery. Thank you to Gary Gray and his colleagues who coordinate our local Adventist Forum chapter for the invitation to speak today. I've chosen to present on an aspect of my scholarly life that's rooted in our shared Reformation heritage and my own faith journey, as well as, I might add, my years teaching Shakespeare here at Andrews. Some of you may be aware of the Adventist Church's long history of, shall we call it, discomfort with fictive creative arts and the drama of William Shakespeare in particular. I will not give such controversy credence by reviewing those arguments against fiction. Rather, I choose to combat the specious binary that pits doctrine against story by demonstrating how, in the work I study, the England and its literature of the Renaissance and Reformation, theology and theater both reacted to a similar crisis in knowing the universe, intersecting with each other and informing one another in uneasy but provocative ways. Some of you know, as has been mentioned, that I'm a Shakespeare scholar specializing in the meaning-making of performance on stage and screen. So, no surprise, this afternoon, that's what I'm thinking about. I'll be reflecting upon the distinct epistemological crisis of William Shakespeare's moment in time, a crisis regarding the accessibility of truth profoundly expressed in the poet's great tragedy, Hamlet, from 1599, and reworked in two film adaptations, that of Laurence Olivier from 1948 and Kenneth Branagh's adaptation from 1996. By means of an elaborate play within a play, you may remember that at the center of Hamlet, there's a staged drama that takes place. By means of that embedded play, Hamlet overtly meditates on theatrical representation as a mechanism of truth-telling, both in competition with and, at times, complementary to faith practices. I propose to outline today a genealogy of knowing that begins with the paradigmatic alterations of the Reformation, turns to Hamlet's own meta-theatrical reflections, or again, its reflections on what the purpose of theater is, and concludes with two 20th century film adaptations in order to demonstrate how Shakespeare's tragedy grapples with the same questions confronted by theologians during the years of evangelical reform in England. What can we know? And how do we know? William Shakespeare's Hamlet famously troubles the boundaries of knowing and not knowing, of being and not being. Written in an era that witnessed vast changes to established epistemological paradigms or systems by which humans know, Hamlet accumulates uncertainty in one magnificent five-act drama. A profoundly interrogative play, Hamlet opens in the opacity of darkness with the question, "Who's there?" Like other plays from this phase of Shakespeare's career, the late 1590s and early 1600s, Hamlet poses questions compulsively, utilizing 439 question marks in the Folger digital text edition. And then this is compared, let's say, to an earlier play like Taming of the Shrew that has only 353, or The Merchant of Venice with only 221. So Hamlet, like other plays from this time period, is just rife with questions, always asking, trying to understand. Hamlet interrogates then the limits of knowledge and being at a moment that saw religious truth and praxis upended by Protestant reform, modes of inquiry gradually regularized, gradually, by the scientific method, and the frameworks of human being and social organization stretched through the voyages of discovery. You'll be glad I'm not talking about all those epistemological crises, but I wanted us to remember it's so much coming at these thinkers at this moment in history. Even as the printing press also facilitated mass dissemination of knowledge, the authority of that knowledge, of what could and should be known, became increasingly vexed. As Robert Wyman explains, quote, "The gradual spread of literacy, nourished by the increased circulation of printed vernacular texts, complicated mechanisms of representation, and compromised authoritative meaning." And what I see in this time period is this tension always between expanding knowledge, the sense that we know more, but simultaneously this terror that we don't know what matters and what is actually authoritative and significant. It's sort of what happens, I think, when one goes to graduate school. It's a similar experience. I take as my first point of departure in the catalog of transforming knowledge the printed text of Hamlet itself. The complex textual status of Hamlet exemplifies the power of the printing press to expand knowledge and simultaneously occlude authoritative knowing. David Scott Caston asserts that 16th century printing house practices leave their mark upon the text, distorting it even as they preserve and set it forth. So dated again to 1599 and 1600, this really amazingly productive time in Shakespeare's career, Hamlet exists in three highly contested early print versions. And always the problem when you're reading Hamlet is, well, which of them is Hamlet, essentially? Let me remind you what they are. First, a 1603 quarto. This is like a cheap paperback version. A 1604-05 quarto, and then the folio version. This is the anthologized one. So that first one, Q1, sometimes is called the bad quarto, as if it were a recalcitrant child. The 1603 quarto has long been identified as what we call memorial reconstruction. This is a version of the play set down from memory by a few actors who performed in it, and they were often identified as sort of pirated copies for people trying to make a buck. The often preferred and more self-consciously literary 1604 Q2 is much, much longer and is derived from, we think, an authorial draft. So it seems to have more validity, doesn't it, than Q1. And then I love the protestations of the frontispiece of the Q2 version of Hamlet. I don't know if you can read it. This machine is called In Focus, but I'm not sure it is. Anyway, in the middle of the frontispiece on the right, this is of that Q2 version. Here is what they've printed. This is newly imprinted and enlarged to almost as much a gain as it was, according to the true and perfect copy. So you can feel, right, that sort of anxiety about, we will nail down the right version of this play. And again, I think make money on it. So, Leah Marcus, great scholar of this whole conundrum over the texts of Hamlet, compellingly demonstrates that Q1 and Q2 texts differ dramatically in terms of their relative orthodoxy. Q1's questioning takes place against a ground of basic epistemological stability, but the Q2 Hamlet, again, this longer, we think, authorially manuscript one, inhabits a more inhospitable and unfathomable universe, and is perhaps why scholars find it fascinating. And then, of course, the 1623 folio, the third version of Hamlet, likewise differs from the second one, appears again to be from another author manuscript, and so there's just a lot of uncertainty about which of these texts we should be considering. The folio, as you'll remember, was printed 7 years after Shakespeare died, so it lacks, in fact, his imprimatur. Thus, because the very text that constitutes Hamlet cannot be established with absolute assurance, it exists, again, as multiple identities, the print history of Hamlet generates epistemological uncertainty before ever the density of its historical context and literary expression has been unpacked. So we haven't even read a word, and already we're in this sort of land of confusion. Just as the printing press revolutionized and complicated access to knowledge, again as seen in the case of Hamlet's text, so the secular theater proposed its own approach to the questions of truth. As is well known, the embodied art of theater emerged as a vibrant form of popular entertainment in the London of the late 16th century when the first public theater, which was simply called the theater, opened in 1576. When Protestantism swept away the varied festival habits of the Catholic liturgical year, the secular theater provided urban diversion in the wake of Roman church practice. Built upon centuries-long traditions of medieval church drama with morality plays where you have virtue and vice battling over the everyman's character, the secular theater at its height between 1576 and 1642 entertained tens of thousands of Londoners and offered rival modes of knowing, again, both in sympathy and in competition with Orthodox faith. Gary Taylor estimates, just so we have a sense of how popular this was as a medium, that the London theaters entertained weekly audiences of 18 to 24,000 at a time when London's total population was about 200,000 and grew to approximately 375,000. Because it was an intensely religious time, you can imagine this is not a surprise. A robust anti-theatrical pamphlet campaign developed during this golden age of drama precisely because of the threatening popularity of theater. Whenever I read these folks, I can so hear the echoes of some traditional church folk of our own era. And let me give you an example of that. One author, Stephen Gossin, launches the familiar slippery slope argument in opposition to the temptations of the theater and its playwright. And I have the quote on the screen for you. When his skill, this is the playwright, is shown to make his scholar as good as ever twanged, he prefers you to piping, from piping to playing, from play to pleasure, from pleasure to sloth to sleep, from sleep to sin, from sin to death, from death to the devil. If you take your learning apace and pass through every form without revolting. Mm-hmm. Despite such outcry, the rituals of the early modern theater and those of the Reformed English Church bear more resemblance to one another than churchmen might have willingly admitted at the time. For example, embodied and performed repetitive actions, an overarching narrative with protagonist, antagonist, conflict, and promised resolution, think sort of great controversy, an attentive audience, an agreed upon commitment to the unseen and the unknown characterize both theater and worship. Daniel Swift has rightly pointed out that the origins of the Elizabethan commercial theater lie within the liturgy of the late medieval church. Though early modern reformers often used the language of theater to excoriate the impostures of Catholicism, they were always acting, priests were. The theatrical nature of enacted ritual could not be entirely eliminated from the Protestant liturgy, and the London theater capitalized on the overlap between its own epistemological shadowing and the practices of faith, suggesting that truth could be discovered outside the confines of the cathedral and through the embodied representational fiction of secular drama. This brings us then to the major catalyst of change in 16th century England. The epistemological threat of both the printing press and the theater derived in large part from the era's seismic revolution in systems of knowing, the Protestant Reformation. For over 1,000 years, the Catholic Church had established the truth about humanity's relationship to the cosmos and the divine, guarding theological orthodoxy and setting the rituals by which humans affirmed the nature of truth. Thanks to the zealous work of Protestant reformers, English men and women confronted a world where what had been true no longer was, and faced significant transformation in cornerstone beliefs. For example, the real presence of Jesus Christ in the communion bread and the wine, the existence of purgatory as a crucial stage of the afterlife, the believer's access to scriptural truth in the vernacular, the efficaciousness of ritual devotion, the necessity of priest-mediated confessional rites, and the role of human effort in the salvific transaction. These deeply contested aspects of religious truth provoked debate in the 16th century between reformers and Catholics, but also fueled, as you well know, internecine conflict between segments of the reform movement, differing over the extent of needed religious change. The transition from Catholic to Reformed faith in England exposed the very human hands responsible for much church doctrine. Committees debated how much reform to implement and which doctrines from continental evangelicals to import. Doctrines we now take for granted as foundational to Protestant faith actually, as you know, took much of the 16th century to become creed. For many eager reformers, Archbishop Thomas Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer, designed to replace the Catholic order of service in England and regularize Reformed church practice, still bore the marks of Catholic liturgical tradition, because of course it was based on that, and hedged theological assertions about, for example, the real presence in the communion bread and wine, as well as the role of intercessory prayer for the deceased. As Swift argues, the first Book of Common Prayer, dating from 1549, is a document of compromise with many fathers and origins, a careful blend of the novel and the traditional, of Catholic language and Protestant theology, of new meaning and old structure. And Remy Targoff adds, the prayer book that was issued in 49 tempered its innovative changes to public worship by incorporating traditional forms of prayer. So you can see how the early versions of Protestantism in England were about easing people from one structure of knowing to another. In the landmark, then, 1549 prayer book published and adopted under Edward VI, this is Henry VIII's son, the liturgical language created for the commemoration of the Lord's Supper was an example of speaking in two voices, again, of traversing these two different modes of knowing, not absolutely denying the possibility of transubstantiation, but rather allowing the Catholic belief to reside uncomfortably alongside Reformed language that characterized the service as symbolic rather than literal. And again, I'm not sure you can see it, but this is the heading to the liturgy for the Lord's Supper on the right, and it reads, and again, just hear language that for us resonates as Protestant sitting alongside Catholic language. The top label is the Supper of the Lord and the Holy Communion, commonly called the Mass. So again, clearly invoking another theological mode. Dermot McCullough's magisterial biography of Archbishop Cranmer, it's amazing, it describes this architect of English Reformed faith as already aware that he was walking a tightrope in what he was doing in 49, and that both friends and enemies could misunderstand the traditionalism of much within its covers. Though later editions of the prayer book incorporated more unapologetic terms to refute the doctrine of transubstantiation as well as the state of the dead, the 49 edition stands as an example of the uncertain territory traversed by English men and women expected to adopt the new beliefs even as those doctrines were yet to be fully articulated. From the perspective of the 21st century, the reform in England appears a fait accompli, but for men and women in the 16th century, the possibility that a change in monarchical power would bring with it an attendant shift in church practice continually threatens stability. And I'm just reminding you of a history we know here, but that gives a sense of the kind of amazing complexities of the era. Though the reign of Henry VIII catalyzed schism from the Roman Church, as we know, Henry VIII died a theological Catholic, and it remained for his evangelical educated young son, Edward VI, under the guidance of Cranmer, to institute change. But the short-lived, what they called purification of the English Church, along strictly reformed lines, soon gave way at the death of Edward VI to the reestablishment of Catholic right with the accession of Mary I. Only the tempering reign of Elizabeth I charted a via media between Catholic and Protestant to ensure a long-standing reform settlement in England that would curtail Catholic resistance and quell Puritan grumbling. But that might be an overstatement. They continued to grumble. But it's her long reign that, of course, establishes Protestant practice in England. The great Tudor historian G.R. Elton identifies as a signature question then of this age what we can know about the establishment of Protestant faith in the hearts and minds of English men and women. The exhaustive work of historian Eamon Duffy illustrates that in parishes across England, churches followed royal orders to adopt the iconoclasm of Protestant faith, but simultaneously secreted objects of religious veneration from the Catholic tradition that might just be put into use once again. Duffy cites parish after parish that sold off relics as they were being ordered to, whitewashed imagery, dismantled rood lofts, and I'm only inflicting one holiday trip photo on you. And that was a lot of restraint. And that is to show you a rood loft on the far left from York Minster. And I am so sorry that the image from Fox's Book of Martyrs is not showing up so well here, but it's a delightful image celebrating the carting off of popery from England and all of its, paltry, as the image calls it. So Duffy cites all these parishes that sold off relics, whitewashed the imagery in the churches, dismantled the rood lofts, and filled in saints' niches, all the while secretly concealing statuary, vestments, and portions of those disassembled altars. They're just amazing stories about pieces of altars hidden in barn lofts and all kinds of amazing things from this time. In fact, for the short Catholic resurgency of Mary I's reign, records indicate that local people brought out and returned, or sold back, sacred objects that had been removed during Edward's reign. These material traces of Reformation history reveal a people shaken by the loss of 1,000 years of religious practice. While a compliant majority may well have offered obedience in a brutally authoritarian culture, the records of hoarded objects remind us that for many English men and women, the assertions of Protestantism might not yet have taken full root. Thus, two potent systems for knowing theological truth vie for allegiance throughout the 16th century in England and create the ferment of uncertainty in which William Shakespeare and his contemporaries wrote their magnificent literature. Hamlet begins by overtly confronting one major source of theological contention, the debate over the existence of purgatory, the notion of that intermediate place between heaven and hell, and the system of indulgences and pardons that's meant to relieve the suffering of the soul imprisoned within it. Targeting purgatory as an extra-biblical doctrine essential to the institutional structure, authority, and power of the Catholic Church precisely because it was such a money generator. This is why it was such a ripe target, shall we say. The reformers attacked that elaborate system they viewed as profoundly corrupt. David Cressy confirms that though the inevitability of death was untoppled, its meaning, performance, and trappings were all subject to intense questioning in the generations of the Reformation. Protestant zealots reserved their sharpest vitriol for those most egregious manifestations of purgatorial doctrine, the elaborate purpose-built chapels or chantries that were endowed by the wealthy and installed with the priest to sing daily mass on behalf of the dear departed. While reformers viewed the wholesale destruction of chantries and the elimination of the prayers for the dead from the prayer book liturgy as purification, historians have argued that these changes deeply altered how the English knew and perceived the once superable barrier between living and dead. It's a far different thing when no longer can your prayers impact the state of the dead person that you've lost. It changed the experience of mourning very profoundly for these individuals. And this is why the prayers for the dead linger in the prayer book as well for a while. As Stephen Greenblatt reminds us, even the monarch responsible for the schism with Rome, Henry VIII, made provision in his will for payment of the poor to pray for his speedy transition from purgatory to heaven. We wonder about its efficacy, I suppose, there. Stipulating that a bequest of 1,000 marks should be utilized, in a quote from the will, to move the poor people that shall have our alms to pray heartily unto God for remission of our offenses, which we know are many, and the wealth of our soul. The questionable theology of purgatory surfaces in Shakespeare's play as a trigger then for epistemological uncertainty and the means by which the drama explores how humans know and what role theater can play in accessing truth. Though Hamlet still enjoys pride of place as a standard text of secondary and tertiary English literary education, I hope you won't mind, a short plot summary both refreshes the memory and perhaps spotlights its web of epistemological ambiguities. Hamlet chronicles the eponymous character's effort to process the following. 1, the death of his father. 2, the remarriage of his mother, Queen Gertrude, to Hamlet's uncle Claudius. And 3, the procedural murkiness by which Uncle Claudius forestalls primogeniture to become king when the rule should perhaps fall to the son, Prince Hamlet. The natural processes of mourning and loss quick step into crisis when the ghost of Hamlet's father appears to his son and accuses his brother of fratricide. Though Hamlet receives this visitation from the ghost in Act 1, as you'll remember, he does not fulfill the paternal call for vengeance until Uncle Claudius dies in Act 5. For over 400 years, critics, readers, and theater goers have debated the cause of Hamlet's delayed action. However, read in the context of the 16th century's own crisis of knowing, Hamlet's delay seems quite reasonable. How can he know with undoubted certainty that the ghost speaks truth and calls righteously for vengeance? Young Hamlet opts at the center of the play, and again, this is the scene of interest to me today, to deploy the mimetic illusions of theater as a test of the ghost's truth value. Hamlet produces, with the help of a troupe of traveling actors who arrive conveniently, the Mousetrap. This play recounts a regicide much like the one Hamlet Sr.'s ghost describes to his son, and Hamlet hopes that theatrical imitation of the sinful act will elicit a guilty response from the spectator King Claudius. Thus, for young Hamlet, the embodied representations of theater may well provoke confession, illuminate truth, and fulfill a religious task at just a moment in history when what was truth and which cultural institutions held the corner on such definitions came into question. The theological ambiguities of Hamlet Sr.'s ghostly presence grow obviously out of the religious controversies of the era. Early in the play, the ghost explains that as an inhabitant of purgatory, he must suffer to atone for his unshriven death. And I quote, doomed for a certain term to walk the night, and for the day confined to fast and fires. Thus, in terms of the competing epistemologies of 16th century faith, Shakespeare chooses to articulate a ghost of distinctly Catholic persuasion, a denizen of a realm no longer credited as extant by Reformed theologians. In fact, in Protestant faith, the ghost could just as likely be an evil spirit come to wreak havoc as Horatio worries to his friend, and I quote from the play again, what if it, the ghost, tempt you toward the flood, my lord, or to the dreadful summit of the cliff that beetles o'er the base into the sea, and there assume some other horrible form which might deprive your sovereignty of reason and draw you into madness? Shakespeare capitalizes on doctrinal uncertainty in his depiction of what some have termed a Catholic ghost to deepen anxiety over what can be known. Hamlet does not immediately act nor give absolute credence to the questionable shape, as it's called, of the ghost, and the ensuing scenes display Hamlet adopting a variety of acts or roles in order to sleuth out the secrets of his uncle's Danish court. The extent to which theater offers an alternative route for knowing truth is explored by one of the most meta-theatrical moments in Shakespeare's canon, the most deliberate meditation upon what theater can do, when the hero of Hamlet gives instructions to the theater troupe about to enact the mousetrap. He says, suit the action to the word to the action, with this special observance, that you o'erstep not the modesty of nature, for anything so or done is from the purpose of playing, whose end, both at the first and now, was and is to hold as 'twere the mirror up to nature, to show virtue her feature, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time, his form and pressure. For Shakespeare's Hamlet, theater is a mimetic, embodied art form that holds the mirror to nature. He singles out a moral function attributed to that imitative art. According to Hamlet, theater teaches virtue and warns against vice, sharing that task again with the institutions of religious education. His instructions continue as he seeks to rein in extemporary additions of fooling, and he urges them, and let those that play your clowns speak no more than is set down for them. For there be of them that will themselves laugh to set on some quantity of barren spectators to laugh too, though in the meantime some necessary question of the play be then to be considered. That's villainous, and shows a most pitiful ambition in the fool that uses it. What concerns Hamlet, and I think directors in general, when they're playing with comedians, is that the actor's instinct for cheap laughs might hinder the drama's necessary questions, the central thematic concerns of the performance. So for Hamlet, drama centers on necessary questions that communicate moral and ethical truths and confront audience members with their own failings in order to prompt self-reflection. And this should sound like very old notions of drama. This should sound like the notions of drama from classical Greece, for example. And you should hear the sort of notion, I think, of catharsis from Aristotle in this understanding that Hamlet presents to us. So again, theatrical performance should echo in some way in his notions liturgical function, as it's about, again, forcing us to confront evils in our own character. The mousetrap consists of two forms of mimetic display. First, a dumb show, which presents an enacted but unspoken summary of the play with the exaggerated gestures that we'll recognize from silent film, the sort of that kind of thing. Then after the dumb show, there's a scripted drama that follows it very explicitly, again, is mirroring the death of Hamlet's father. Both versions reveal a king and queen protesting love to one another, a villainous relation who kills the king by pouring a vial of poison into his ear, and the wooing and wedding of the unwitting widow by the murderer. Since the murder follows so closely that described by his ghostly father, Hamlet aims to trigger a confessional reaction from his uncle that will confirm or by its absence deny the truth claims of the ghost. In so doing, Hamlet will then possess the certainty necessary to justify recriminatory or conciliatory action, depending, of course, on the outcome. And he enlists his friend Horatio to be an observer, suggesting again that the truth needs to be verified with another individual. He says to Horatio with regards to the play, I prithee, when thou seest that act afoot, this is the setup to the mousetrap, even with the very comment of thy soul, observe my uncle. if his occulted guilt do not itself unkennel in one's speech, and I have to pause so we can enjoy that lovely verb, unkennel, that sort of imagery of dogs getting set loose. So if his occulted guilt do not itself unkennel in one's speech, it is a damned ghost that we have seen, and my imaginations are as foul as Vulcan's stithy. Give him heedful note, for I, mine eyes, will rivet, and again, fabulous verb, right, to his face, and after we will both our judgment join in censure of his seeming. So Hamlet's instructions to Horatio again make explicit the epistemological stakes of the mousetrap and stress that subjective sensory observation must be checked by multiple viewpoints. Though 20th century film versions do not share with Hamlet the precise crisis of knowing, so richly informing the original play text, adaptations of this crucial play within a play continue to reveal assumptions about the epistemological landscape 400 years later. And again, this is always my interest in my scholarship, to think about what are the pressures creating the text, and then when we rework them on stage and film, how are those sort of traces of that heritage still present? While film adapters may see little profit in recreating the specific theological concerns of Shakespeare's moment in time, film does deploy techniques, as you know, that participate in the play's broader epistemological concerns by controlling visual access to truth. These techniques narrow the range of truth-telling possible, present moral evaluation, and endeavor to control the emotive range of a scene. In addition to determining, just as in theater, things like scene design, costuming, and casting, filmmakers make choices that limit interpretive possibilities. They elect the scenes to be shown and those to be omitted. The angle from which a shot will be taken, the relative proximity of the camera to the subject, the lighting scheme, the manner in which scenes will be knit together, and the quality of the musical underscoring. Because it is an art form driven by the controlling gaze of the camera and the deus ex machina hand of the editor, film creates quite self-consciously an aesthetic transaction playing upon how viewer knowledge can be shaped, directed, and of course misdirected. Laurence Olivier's Oscar-winning 1948 Hamlet, which Olivier directed and starred in, is a landmark in Shakespearean film history as the first major adaptation, although there had been many before, and many silent film adaptations. But this is the first major adaptation of Hamlet. Critics have often called the film an essay in Hamlet because it cuts 50% of the play and runs 155 minutes. And you can understand, because at that point in film history, whether or not Shakespeare was even as such a wordy art form was even suited to film was deeply contested. So Olivier eliminates then, and this to me is an interesting choice, he eliminates the spoken play and keeps the dumb show, which is an exact opposite of typically what performance history over the last 400 years had been. And so we see the dumb show in the film. So to recreate Hamlet as an on-screen exploration of epistemological crisis, Olivier utilizes a range of techniques throughout the mousetrap to signal the limits of what humans can know. And I would say the sort of parallel I see here is that in the same way that all this sort of expansion of knowledge in the 16th century is creating both a sense of, wow, we know more, and ah, what matters in all of this, and what is it now that we can't know, I see the same thing happening in the film, where you have this desire to look and see and know in tension with, but maybe perhaps even that questing after knowledge is a thwarted endeavor. So in Olivier, the strict management of lighting to mimic the patterns of film noir, which he was inspired by, immediately enters the viewer into a world where not everything can be seen and known. It's just hard to see things in this film. It obscures visual certitude by utilizing high contrast lighting to create these shafts of light and dark, which you can see, I think, in this example of a still. And then it uses low-key lighting that has these diffuse shadows and pools of light as well. So all of the film is constantly reminding you of how little you can actually see, even though these sort of shafts of dark and light are often about, oh, but the world is very clearly divided between good and evil. But the difficulty of navigating that is getting echoed in this, the obscurity of seeing throughout the lighting schemes of the film. So in addition, Olivier utilizes a searching camera movement that imitates the questing after truth of the title character. So repeatedly, the restless camera carries the viewer behind the depicted theater audience so that the film viewer overlooks the shoulders of the Danish courtiers. So for a total of 1.5 minutes in this 7-minute scene, the camera swings in a kind of semicircle arc back and forth behind the courtly audience during the dumb show. And this over-the-shoulder hovering then spotlights the act of viewing. And you can see here a really clever thing that Olivier and his photographer Desmond Dickinson do is that the camera will hover, it'll move behind the arc of viewers and then hovers right behind, this is Gertrude in the bottom right corner and her husband Claudius, the unlawful king, in the center there. And it will just hover and watch the play through their heads, essentially, and it does that again for several moments so that you see the silhouetted outline of Claudius's crown. Cleverly, this device grants to the film audience the observational responsibilities that Hamlet has, of course, assigned to Horatio. We watch for Claudius's guilty response to the production. However, the film simultaneously constrains viewer access to the more traditional evidence of facial expression. You'll notice we're behind his head. So it repeatedly displaying only the back silhouette of the king's increasingly discomfited figure, and you can see him fidgeting. By controlling access to Claudius's face, then, Olivier denies sustained observation of the body part essential to, as Vanessa Corradera has argued, quote, exploration of inwardness, thoughts, emotions, sins, and character. The film replicates this paradox that viewing both expands and contracts knowing through its positioning of Hamlet's friend and fellow watcher, Horatio. Though the camera conveys a sense of the diversity of viewer perspective as it looks over the shoulder of those courtiers, it privileges the witness of one viewer in particular, Hamlet's friend, Horatio. In so doing, Olivier limits the film viewer's engagement with visual evidence just as Horatio's knowledge increases. So when the prologue walks on stage to introduce the play, Horatio's back obscures the central portion of the picture plane for a noticeable duration of 20 seconds. And so again, in film, you have to think that's quite a long time for us to be looking essentially at Horatio's back here on the right of the picture plane. And you're sort of craning, trying to see what he's looking at, but we're being blocked from it. Again, I think it's a fascinating choice of camera angle. So that Horatio functions for much of the scene as a foreground qualifier, an object in the foreground of the visual plane that slightly or wholly obscures a space of sensory information that's just beyond him. And the camera dollies to the right and pushes him to the left in the picture plane, the back of yet another spectator obscures view of the playing space. So thus, even as Horatio attempts to establish the ghost's veracity, he impedes the knowing of the film viewer and becomes quite literally a barrier to truth. Just as he gains more information, the viewer strains and strains to see, but we accumulate less evidence. Throughout much of the 7-minute scene, Olivier replicates the perspective of a theater goer by keeping the camera in fairly stable long shot, and this again is an example of that. This choice, however, reduces close-up access to the facts of facial expression yet again, that again we would probably use to verify Claudius's guilt. Well over 50% of the scene, so 4 minutes and 20 seconds, is presented in long shot, holding the viewer at a significant distance from the human form, face, and its specificity of expression. While the camera often maintains long shot at roughly human eye level, a number of moments are filmed with the camera on a boom that elevates point of view. And this is a trope throughout the film, where when Olivier wants to launch a kind of moral comment, the camera booms up and looks down for long durations, and this is the case when the king and queen first appear in this scene. The camera is up for 42 seconds looking down on Claudius and Gertrude, just to remind us that's the moral position we should have in relation to them as well. So thus, Hamlet is criticizing Claudius's court from using the way Olivier uses his camera there. So Olivier's filming choices both give and take epistemological privilege to and from the audience, relying on a camera angle that tells us moral certainty, these guys are bad, but also keeping us at a distance so that we can't actually see up close the way in which human form would communicate to us either. Olivier, his photographer Dickinson, and his editor Helga Cranston manage camera proximity and scene pacing masterfully so that the shot selection, musical scoring, and editing crescendo in synchrony to a close-up of the guilty King Claudius, played by Basil Sidney. Claudius at last halts the performance just as the dumb show most strikingly recreates his own act of fratricide and marriage to his former sister-in-law. The low angle close-up on Claudius calling, "Give me some light," bears the heavy weight of truth because Olivier has so severely limited visual access to verifiable evidence up until that moment. Because of this, the viewer experiences a sort of frisson of truth discovered, a ta-da effect, if you will, as we sort of close in at last on him here. In addition, Sidney's Claudius draws attention to the film's schematic association of light and sight as metaphors of knowing by covering his own eyes with his hands as if to block out the truth exposed by the dumb show's storytelling, what's been mirrored to him in the artistic form he's not so fond of. The gesture implies that by mirroring the guilty act, the theater has overpowered Claudius and forced his nature into the light. Thus, although Olivier's filmmaking has demonstrated that access to truth can be obscured, even as we seek it, the scene concludes with a direct affirmation of theater's moral and revelatory capacity. Furthermore, the heavy-handed presence of editor and lighting director insists that film, the progeny of theater, plays a significant mediating role in the meaning-making transaction. Much has been made of the Oedipal ties that link Laurence Olivier to contemporary Shakespeare impresario Kenneth Branagh, who you might know more from directing the first Thor movie, but which has all manner, right, of Hamlet echoes. Exactly. So, in 1996, Branagh released his own four-hour film version. So please feel like if he has Olivier as a kind of shadow, Olivier makes this short 155-minute film, Branagh's going to do the whole thing, which is folio text and bits from the second quarto that are lovely that aren't in the folio. So it's complete. And of course, he wrote, directed, and starred in it. And in interviews, God bless him, promoting the film's launch, Branagh acknowledged indebtedness to Olivier. At the same time, he loudly insisted on difference. And you can just see it in the aesthetic, can't you? This is such a resolutely bright Hamlet when you compare it to the kind of medieval darkness of that 1948 film. So Branagh's mousetrap, occurs in the well-lit grandeur of a Baroque Blenheim palace where the exteriors are shot. The location and lighting project a very different form of epistemological crisis from that dramatized in Olivier's film. Branagh's film conveys the fear of an evil that struts unnoticed in bright daylight and does not skulk in the darkened corner. Branagh nonetheless signals the perilous nature of that world by beginning with a tilt shot that moves downward at scene commencement to display a steeply raked seating area. The king and queen take their seat at the top of this raked seating area, but you have a sense of the instability of their position because the camera cuts 12 different times to their point of view at the top of that seating area, and you have this real insistence that their world is incredibly fragile, as it should be since it's built on regicide. Just as in Olivier's film, Branagh positions Horatio as a co-truth seeker. Throughout the scene, Horatio, concealed behind a curtain, as you see here, watches through this delicate pair of opera glasses. On six occasions, and again, this is about a 10-minute scene, so it's a little bit longer, of course, than the Olivier one, the editor cuts to shots taken as if through the characteristically circumscribed perspective of Horatio's opera glasses. So you can just see the little nose piece indentations here. And I do love Derek Jacobi's kind of wily look out of the corner of his eye there playing Claudius. So you have that kind of reminder of the watching activity, the collection of data that Horatio's meant to be doing as there are these cuts to the opera glasses. And then to amplify this, Branagh relies on a pretty manic editing. So in a film that is replete with bravura length, continuous takes, so much of the film is so very much about showing Branagh's mastery of Shakespeare, and so the takes will be incredibly long, and so you're there sort of wondering, have mercy, he's just spoken 100 lines and not taken a cut. And so there's all this kind of lovely, delightful showing off, but what's interesting about the mousetrap scene is that those long takes aren't there, it's just boom, 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 cut, 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 and so you have a very different energy that's happening there, and and I think we're meant to think about, well, why did he shift modes there? So this transpires then with a superfluity of quick cuts as Branagh's editor, Neil Farrell, moves viewers abruptly from shot to shot to shot, and just like a shotgun almost. The editor, largely responsible for the driving rhythms of the scene, establishes a pattern that alternates between shots of the performed play and then these quick shots of spectators watching and reacting to the content. In the space of this 10-minute scene, the editor breaks to a series of quick cuts 8 different times, at least every 2 minutes. As in the Olivier version, Branagh's film technique stresses the act of seeing as epistemological tool. The heavy reliance on reaction shots leads the witness, to borrow a legal term, insisting there must be a reaction to what's taking place on stage. But Branagh's approach, I think, leaves open for debate exactly what the play production is proving. As the Prince of Denmark, Branagh presents a histrionic Hamlet near giddy with the cleverness of his theatrical trick and the probability that truth will be exposed. Throughout The Mousetrap, Branagh's Hamlet rarely manages to contain his mania. And again, it's a contrast to Olivier, where Olivier's Hamlet is sort of reclining at the feet of Ophelia for much of this scene. But this Branagh's Hamlet is constantly on the move. He leaps up and down from his seat. He rambles onto set. He summarizes the action and interprets aloud the staging, even as actors wait wonderingly by, uncertain when they can continue the scene. In the screenplay, Branagh describes this. He says of Hamlet, he rattles on at speed gleefully. The timing of the reaction shots easily can record not the reaction to truth about the rotten state of Denmark, the act of regicide at its foundation, but rather a simple discomfort with the very inappropriate behavior of the presumptive heir to the throne. So again, Branagh is allowing for multiple truths to be exposed in this moment. As The Mousetrap spoken content veers closer and closer to material directed at the current king and queen, knowing glances between the courtiers multiply, and it's those quick cuts that are showing us that. So for example, the player queen protests for 16 lines that she will never take a second husband. In response, the Danish court shifts awkwardly. It's a kind of awkward turtle moment. Queen Gertrude, who now is relishing, of course, a second marriage, you'll notice them sharing some Turkish delight together. And everyone sort of watching, are they noticing the awkwardness of this moment? Thus, the film viewer may wonder, are the reactions actually bearing witness to the hidden truth about Hamlet Sr.'s death and Claudius's guilt, or to a public's concern over the increasingly erratic behavior of the heir apparent? So the quick cuts culminate, then, in seemingly unequivocal evidence of the ghost's veracity. But Branagh ensures that such evidence remains accessible only to the film audience. 3 quick cut rounds occur in the space of the final minute of The Mousetrap as he films it, when Hamlet summarizes the murder about to occur on stage. And crucially, during this last round of rapid shots, the filmmaker crosscuts to interpolated images of, in fact, Hamlet Sr.'s death, where you see Hamlet Sr., you see the hand of the murderer just about to pour the poison into the porches of his ears. All of this editing energy then culminates focus on Claudius's confessional gesture as with each reaction cut to Claudius, the camera is zooming in closer to his face and then cutting to these scenes from the murder. So it's so obvious that you're meant to think what we're now seeing, this is the dying brother, what you're seeing then is what Claudius is remembering, triggered again by the theatrical display before him, and then finally the camera closing in on the murderer's eyes before he calls for light. So again, the implied logic of the moment is that the interpolated and cross-cut material of Hamlet Sr.'s death represents Claudius's conscience pricking him. But again, in the case of Branagh's adaptation, film is supplanting theater as the mechanism that is best capable of truth-telling. So you really have, I think, Shakespeare, Olivier, and Branagh all kind of wrestling with what is the purpose of my art form? What is its avenue towards truth? Where are its pitfalls, if you will? So Shakespeare's Hamlet taps into an anxiety then about certitude that centerpieces theater as an aid of knowledge. On the one hand, The Mousetrap appears to work. In the very next scene, Shakespeare presents Claudius kneeling in a confessional booth, wrestling with his guilty conscience. So again, I love the way that the play has put the workings of the theater right next to a moment of religious devotion. Claudius prays, "Oh, my offense is rank. It smells to heaven. It hath the primal eldest curse upon it." Again, that reference, of course, to Cain and Abel, a brother's murder. Since Hamlet's mousetrap compels such a direct confession of guilt, it can be easy to overlook the problems inherent in its representation of drama as a sacred theater of knowing. A second look reveals that Shakespeare crafts the mousetrap as an inexact mirror of the Hamlet senior murder. The mousetrap stages a nephew plotting to kill an uncle, making it possible that not a brother killing a brother, making it possible then that Claudius's initial reaction might be to what he perceives as a none too subtle declaration from Hamlet that he's going to kill his uncle Claudius. So in this slant test of truth, Shakespeare toys with the audience and tweaks his own claims for the power of his chosen art form that holds the mirror up to nature. Both the play text and the adaptations of Olivier and Branagh claim a role for the respective art forms of theater and film in the truth-telling business. However, they continue to acknowledge features of their art that impede certainty and drive humans to the miraculous consolations of faith. 4. What Hamlet ultimately asserts, even as it wrangles with the theological uncertainties of Reformation England and polemicizes the epistemic functionality of theater, is the enduring capacity of faith to soothe human doubts. The troubled prince avers only moments before his own death, there is special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. Since no man of aught he leaves knows what is to leave betimes, let be. The play builds towards this revision of Hamlet's previous to-be questions and echoes that earlier distressed uncertainty by heavy use of that signature to-be verb structure. The Prince Hamlet of Act 5 no longer thrashes out whether or not he possesses enough data to justify action, but rather accepts the finite limits of human knowledge, admitting that though he cannot know what will come, he can be ready, open to, and trusting of the benevolent hand of a special providence. This magnificent reconciliation with the unknown evokes the image of the sparrow's fall taken from St. Matthew and rooted in the theology of sola fide, or faith alone, that had previously triggered so much painful alteration to 16th century epistemological structures. Shakespeare adapts the image from a passage in the Gospel of Matthew in which Christ comforts his disciples. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? And one of them shall not fall on the ground without your Father? Yea, and all the hairs of your head are numbered. Fear ye not, therefore, ye are of more value than many sparrows. Whosoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father, which is in heaven. The Reformed editors of the Geneva Bible render explicit the signature sola fide implications of the last verse by glossing, quote, whosoever therefore shall confess me as, quote, and acknowledge me his only Savior. Thus, in a gorgeous and quintessentially Shakespearean voltafache, the play's hero takes solace in the mysteries of faith made manifest through the salvific completeness of Christ the Savior. Here, the very matter of epistemological crisis and uncertainty in Renaissance England, the backdrop of this tragedy's knotty complexities, becomes the source of assurance at last. Shakespeare's titular hero draws near life's end and asserts simultaneously the unknowable timing, means, and purposes of a providential hand and the knowable certainty of that divine and benevolent control. Tortured by its conditional and future tenses, Hamlet's acceptance of all that remains outside his understanding and beyond the scope of his agency does not come easily, yet it does come. And in so doing, Hamlet both embraces the mysteries of faith as the only comfort to be had in a world rocked by epistemological crisis and insists that the creative fictions of theater may just be a place where such truthful comfort can be sought. For me, as a reader and a scholar, that affirmation of faith's supremacy proves all the more moving precisely because Hamlet wrestles for the length of 5 acts with the epistemological challenges of being finite, tragically unknowing, mortal, and fallen humans. Thank you. I just want to thank all my people. my research group, who gives me criticism that I'm not always happy about, but I hope makes me better. And then, of course, my colleagues, family, and students here at Andrews. Thank you. Dr. Strayer.
No, I'm just passing the microphone.
Okay.
To whoever wants to speak.
Miss Melody.
You spoke in brief about how, obviously, at this time, people were encountering similar anxieties about the performative nature of the theater and the performative nature of the Catholic Church and the Mass and such like that. Did you find a connection or a disparity between Hamlet's belief that the performative theater that he creates can reveal truth and an anxiety in Renaissance England that they were being manipulated through Mass and through the theatrical nature of the Church?
Yes. I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I think, okay, and I don't know if this is answering this question, but I think what you see in the 16th century is amazing double thinking about performance. On the one hand, a celebration of the way that performance is a manifestation of individual agency. I can construct myself in this way very deliberately and be a kind of independent agent. But at the same time, the fear that all performance is fiction. And I do think that that sort of anxiety about when is performance empowering? When can it lead to empathetic understanding by what we see, say, on stage? When can it be deceptive? Those things are always clashing up absolutely right against one another. And I think why maybe I find the time period so interesting when you think about our own, you know, the church traditions and its anxieties about performance and about fiction, you can feel, I think, a lot of, like, the roots of that in this time period as well.
I was struck with slide number 4 that shows us the cover of the play.
Yeah.
And if I'm reading correctly, I know that the print is a little, it's small here, but am I reading correctly? Does the little print on the bottom link the theater and the church?
Yes.
Is it telling us if we want to buy the play to come to church, or at least close
to
the church?
Right, well, you know, absolutely, because we know that the stalls where the books were sold were often right in the aisles of churches. St. Paul's is a great example of that. And there was a lot of complaint about that, about the way that this house of the Lord was being used for commerce, where business transactions happened in churches as well. So that's so awesome that you noticed that, absolutely, that the vending of books was indeed happening in churches in London, again, and so where you have this kind of uncomfortable presence of the commercial in a space that's meant to be sacred as well.
But the shop is under the
crypt. Right, in the crypt.
Focusing more on this cover, I thought it was interesting that they are emphasizing here that this is the text and the text is the authority on what Hamlet means. Mm-hmm. Since at this time there's a call for sola scriptura, would you say that represents their anxiety to return to the text and not people's interpretation of the text?
Right, exactly. That kind of authority of the printed word. But what's so brilliant about when you actually start pushing at what that means, and when you start looking at the history of book and printing at this time, the amazing number of errata that were taking place, that were being formalized every time the item came off the press. And you know that there's this strange practice with printing at this time where if an error was noted in the process of running a text, they would correct it for the subsequent printings from that set, but not go back and trash the first ones they'd done. And so you have this, kind of the rendering concrete of errors in this material that was meant to be certain, authoritative. Yeah, for sure. Dr. Corradera.
I was interested in, so both Olivier and Branagh are notoriously proud for being associated with Shakespeare, right?
Yeah.
And that they know so much. And so I was curious, you explicitly said that the films are not necessarily invoking the theological context mm-hmm. of the 16th century. However, I do wonder, because I know you've done work with these films elsewhere, mm-hmm. I do wonder, do you see either of the films in their depictions of the ghost, perhaps, you know, pre-Mousetrap scene and post-Mousetrap scene, does there seem to be any awareness at all about whether this could be a damned or not damned ghost, and
yes.
whether it's a Catholic or Protestant ghost? Because I love how you're talking about, oh, they're both meditating on theater, but I wonder if, mm-hmm. since they are so knowledgeable, if they are right. somehow gesturing to this debate about the ghost at all or not.
Yeah. I think especially, it's hard to, I think you have to think sort of parse it all out a bit. But I would say off the top of my head, I would say that with the Hamlet by Branagh, that it's so rich on the special effects. It's such an endeavor to make Hamlet exciting to young folk, and so the ghost scenes have the earth kind of moving and the camera doing all kind of wobbling, and then steam coming up from the kind of chasms in the earth. So it's absolutely, I think he's from purgatory. I mean, and it's all like visually. So I guess what I was thinking about with parsing it, though, you'd have to think about what's happening in that moment is, I think, special effects that absolutely are saying this is a Catholic purgatorial ghost, and special effects that are about saying, look, Hamlet's cool, you know? So I think their intention, but that, you know, that's such a good kind of avenue of continuing thought, because in Olivier's ghost, he's a much quieter presence, which I like more. I think one of the things that we can forget, and I've been thinking about today, maybe perhaps because Sue VanderWaal is on our minds, that this is a really profoundly moving play about death and loss, and about how we crave once again to see the loved one who's gone. And so I think that in that vein, the Olivier one is much more treating the ghost in a way that's not sensational, that doesn't have all of those kind of dark associations of purgatory, but is about wishing for the lost one who's gone, for sure. And I've been also mulling, and I'll stop talking in a minute, I'm sorry. But thinking about like how both Olivier and Branagh, I think, do have other kind of deliberately religious pointing that's going on throughout the films, but then it would be interesting to compare that with like, say, a contemporary adaptation like Amla Rita's film, which was the Hamlet starring Ethan Hawke from the 90s, right, as well, that is so relentlessly secular, you know. So I think that would be an informing thing to consider. Thank you. Sorry. Hold on. Dr. Strayer, after Aaron, my mom is looking for the... Erin, do you want them to give the mic to Mom?
It reminds me of the story of Herod and John the Baptist and Herodias, but he was married to his brother's mm-hmm. wife, according mm-hmm. to the scripture. And this story kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that we've had like a kind of swing in literary criticism, and I think that there's a push more recently to return to readings of these plays that attempt to reconstruct their religious context. And you're absolutely right, Mom, that these plays are written by individuals, I think of Shakespeare again and his colleagues, but who knew the Bible in a way that contemporary Americans certainly could never approximate, and who had huge portions of the scriptures by memory because they were read every day in church. And so absolutely we should be feeling, I mean, like even in that confessional line from Claudius, it's invoking Cain and Abel. So certainly we should be hearing all of those kind of biblical stories present in his shaping as well. You're absolutely right. And I think that there's been a return in Shakespeare scholarship to thinking again about, I mean, we use contemporary lenses, postmodern theoretical lenses for interpreting the plays, but at the, I think there's been a resurgence of interest in readings that are that honor the religious roots of these plays as well. Yeah, thank you. Ms. McLean.
One of the things that sometimes I find frustrating with Hamlet is its treatment of Ophelia. Mm. And so, you know, like she gets the truth at the end, and she right. finally gets to speak at the end when she's mad mm-hmm. and mad with grief.
Right.
And I was sort of curious.
Crazy.
Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. yeah. I was sort of curious what the films do with her sort of madness scene yeah. at the end, and, you know, with the flowers in the rue, which is, almost seems very, like, Catholic with
and
all the
ritual, right?
Yeah, and
right.
very ritual. What do the films
Dude,
do?
Yeah, and all the business about is she buried in consecrated ground or not?
Yeah,
is absolutely a matter of church practice also because Ophelia kills herself, she shouldn't then be buried in consecrated ground, and this becomes a point of contention late in the play. And Ophelia, you'll remember, is the young woman Hamlet has been interested in. So I'd have to think about their treatment of Ophelia. I mean, I think one of the challenges with that Olivier one is that Olivier cast a young woman who could have been his daughter. It's pretty repugnant, as Ophelia, and he was playing Hamlet. And in fact, his mom, Eileen Hurley, who played his mom, was his age. So yeah, it was distinctly creepy. So I mean, I think the challenge with the Olivier film is, in his treatment of Ophelia, is how totally disempowered she is by virtue of just being an infant, essentially, in comparison to, say, the amazing, powerful force of Olivier's presence as Hamlet. But you know what I've been thinking about? So I don't think this is answering the question necessarily of representation of her, but I've been chewing on like what I love about this play, and the paper today really grows out of the years of teaching it and in an environment where we could speak about faith at the same time we were thinking about the complexities of the text. One of the things I've been thinking about is, so I love, and to me, that the line about the sparrows fall, that is magnificent, that kind of peace, that kind of let be that he comes to. But I was thinking about how does he get to that point from all of the kind of angsting before that and really unpleasantness about his character for so much of the play, and a lot of it rooted in the treatment of Ophelia. And I was thinking that I think there's an argument to be made that he gets to the acceptance of providence, of the workings of faith, through the acquisition of empathy. And I'm still kind of chewing on how the argument works, but I think that the play is full of orphan children. Ophelia, her brother Laertes, Fortinbras, another figure in the play, and Hamlet are all orphan children. And that one of the things that happens to him late in the play is that you actually see him processing, oh, other people suffer, like me. And well, I caused their suffering.
Yeah, with Ophelia and Laertes'
yes.
father, he's the one
he's who killed their father. Right. So anyway, I've been thinking about, because empathy is such an enormous transformative aspect of character in late Shakespeare, think King Lear. At the end of King Lear, his transformation is because it's like, oh, I'm king and other people have suffered at my hand. And that's not awesome. So I'm like toying on that idea, and I think it hinges on thinking about Ophelia. But I don't have quite an answer of how it happens. Anyway, thank you for asking about her. Mr. Montez.
I think it's coincidence that I just watched a big portion of Laurence Olivier's Hamlet while I was traveling. And I'll be humorous, it was fueled by a movie I liked as a kid called The Last Action Hero, in which they insert Shakespeare as Laurence Olivier. But I think to the point of what you just said, Laurence Olivier makes a career of masking his face, be it in roles or whatnot, to establish his dominant character because he has this boy's face. And I think it was just, and I'm not just merely pointing out, I think it's beautiful that you show the obstruction that he creates in all those scenes to create this feeling of question versus Rana, who in fact has an aged face, one that doesn't have the appearance of boyhood, yet he embraces that. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's a face that's been debated as being too old for Hamlet. And it's just that conflict in nature there that you pointed out with the use of the young woman also, and then his mother being of a similar age.
Yeah, I know. that isn't it just the strangest detail about that Olivier film that you're it's so uncomfortable. But I think a lot of it, there's been lots of interesting stuff about Olivier, exactly. So thinking about the way his ego is driven in these films and how that's also shaping what he chooses to do in them.
It seems like Hamlet is sort of this play about knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And how does knowing end up affecting Hamlet sort of emotionally and mm-hmm. existentially, and how does that link back into the knowing issues going on in theology at that time? What's yeah. the parallels there?
So another thing I've been thinking about, so absolutely, like I think that, so he's so for so much of the play, totally in crisis over the rethinking about his nuclear family that a young man goes through when his father passes and his mother remarries quickly. It forces him to think, well, what did I know about my family and was it all wrong? And so I think it's on so many levels. I think the religious echo is present there, of course, as I've said. But then there's the kind of psychological rethinking about what the family means. You know, I think that he works his way to peace at the end, but I mean, I think that there's still this, this sense of dissatisfaction. And one thing I was thinking about, as I consider, like, what else do I want to do, is that, you know, you read a lot about believers in this time period who accepted. So the degree to which, say, Calvinism and its notions of predestination were adopted in England, I mean, it varies widely in this time period, but you read a lot about believers who adopted the belief in predestination as being so painfully angst over whether or not they were elect or damned, just amazing, almost melancholy that developed in believers because they could not know were they saved or not, and the powerlessness of that because Calvinism is asserting the absolute incapacity to do anything. Right, you need prevenient grace even to draw you to Christ and to make your heart less stony. So I think that's kind of another kind of interesting line to consider, the way that all of Hamlet's sort of concern about what can I know and all what can I know about different levels of experience, how and the melancholy that project constructs in him, how that has a connection to amazing what we know of a sort of religious depression in Calvinist believers at this time.
Question from your former history teacher.
Oh, I know, I was nervous.
Shakespeare wrote all of his plays, as we know, under Queen Elizabeth I and James I. Let's put him back 20 years to the period of Henry VIII. Could he have survived writing plays under Henry VIII at the time when the Reformation is just beginning?
Wow.
Or would he have been thrown in the Tower of London?
Those guys lived a rough and tumble life, man, too. I mean, you know, they were, I mean, you understand why people like Stephen Gosson were so concerned about the theater, because they did. Those playwrights were kind of the low end of social decorum. But I think, you know, that's a really good question, because the plays have this way of being incredibly unorthodox, and at least they're always sort of toying with unorthodoxy. And when you think about early Tudor drama, and we do have, I'm just sort of mulling through other examples, we do have examples of early Tudor drama that was engaging in the controversy of the moment. I think of John Bale's mid-century play called King John. And so that is a play that, because it fed, I would say, Henrician polemic, because it was a play all about, nasty Catholics, it can get produced But yeah, I wonder if there's something about that in fact it takes the stability that comes with Elizabeth's long reign for a more varied contour of drama to emerge. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, fortunately for him, I think Queen Elizabeth I enjoyed the a little theater. More than Henry VIII.
Yeah,
did.
Yeah.
Okay, does that about wrap up the questions then? Mm-hmm. Well, let's all thank Dr. Pittman for his time, contribution.